From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point, a one-way ticket out of town. That's how many cities and countries across the country, cities and counties across the country, are trying to solve the problem of homelessness, and it's an old solution. But the homeless population in the country is rising for the first time since the Great Recession, and now more cities are turning to relocation programs. Do they work? The Guardian launched an 18-month-long investigation to find out. This hour on Point, Bussing the Homeless Out of Town. You can join us on air or online. Does your town or city offer the homeless tickets out of town? Have you received one? How did it work out? We're going to be talking to two reporters from The Guardian who did a long-term project on homelessness in America, and especially that aspect of it. Just get people out of town. The Guardian spoke with 62-year-old Willie Romines, who took a bus from Key West to Ocala, Florida. Because he accepted a free bus ticket from the shelter he was staying in, when he later returned to Key West, he wasn't able to stay there.
It's like, close the door, get out of here, we bought you a bus ticket, you can't come back. That put a hurting on me. I feel like I was swindled. Since I've been banned from the shelter, I've stayed on Smathers Beach, behind buildings, behind bushes, hedgerows. I've slept next to dumpsters and stuff like that. They tell you anything because they want you out of here. They want all the homeless out of Key West.
Joining me now from San Francisco is Alistair G., homelessness editor for The Guardian. The latest investigation is headlined, Bust Out, How America Moves Its Homeless. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org, and I recommend it to you. Alistair, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, how does this policy work? And in a country that really has had a long tradition of freedom of movement, how do you tell somebody they're not welcome back if you give them the means to leave?
Well, so the way it works is pretty similar across all the programs that we spoke to. We made dozens of public records requests to cities across the nation, and we got records back from around 16 cities or counties about their programs, and that added up to a record of around 35,000 journeys over the last decade and a half. And we analyzed those journeys, and we spoke to some of those program managers. And what we learned is that the programs actually are voluntary. No one is going up to a homeless person, generally at least, and saying you have to leave. However, what cities say about programs is that they are a surefire way out of homelessness. Some cities go so far as to describe them in their official records as exits from homelessness, and they include those numbers with the numbers of people who've been given housing. But what we found after really diving into the data is that the picture is actually a lot more nuanced than that would have you believe, and that while some people sure are finding security and stability at the other end, more people are becoming homeless at the other end, or they are finding themselves even homeless back in the city that they came from. So the picture is nowhere near as rosy, I think, as the cities would portray.
I wonder about the level of coordination. If you're handed a bus ticket to Kansas City in Los Angeles or a bus ticket to Roanoke, Virginia in Miami, is there anybody in Miami calling to see if there's any place for you to go in Roanoke? Or is it a kind of no questions asked deal like here, we're giving you the means to get out of here, see ya?
Well, in large part, people are calling ahead to confirm that there is someone who can receive that homeless person at their destination. And we found that this tends to be relatives and friends. However, there's a big difference between someone over the course of a phone call saying, yes, I can look after that person, and success, long-term stability at the other end. So we spoke, for example, to a woman named Rose who took a ticket from Key West to her to Morgantown, West Virginia, where her daughter lived. And over the phone, her daughter said that she'd be able to take care of her mum. But when Rose returned to West Virginia, she found that she'd be sleeping on a couch in a trailer filled with other people. And after a week or two, her daughter ended up taking her to the local homelessness shelter in West Virginia. And then I think 3 weeks after she took the ticket from Key West back to Morgantown, she ended up back on the streets in Key West. And so that's the kind of example where, even if it sounds like someone might be able to help someone out of homelessness, for the city to subsequently describe that as a surefire way out of homelessness is a bit misleading.
One of the interviews that launches from your website, the reporting that was done for The Guardian, is Rose. Now, she's 58 years old and, as you mentioned, relocated from Florida to West Virginia. In her interview with The Guardian, she explained why she wanted to leave Florida, but what eventually brought her back.
I had a seizure and my heart stopped at the soup kitchen, so I wanted to go back to West Virginia and stay with my daughter. They were staying, and it's like in a three-bedroom trailer, and then her little boy slept on the couch where I was sleeping, so they wanted me to go to a homeless shelter. And, well, I didn't want to stay in the homeless shelter in West Virginia because I don't know anybody up there anymore. And from the time I left here to the time I got back, it was exactly 3 weeks.
Alistair, is this, in a sense, a sort of middle-class solution to the problems of intense poverty? These people are already living pretty fragile and in sometimes quite disorganized lives. If someone says, yeah, give me a ticket, I'll go stay with my family, that's one thing. But the families on the other end are often in no position to give these people the help they need.
Well, that's a really good point. I think these programs have names like Homeward Bound and Family Reunification. And I think there is the implicit idea in those names that just by sending someone back to their family, that in and of itself is curative somehow. However, of course, that's not always the case. Solving homelessness is an incredibly complex issue. I'm reminded, for instance, of another person that we spoke to. His name was Quinn, and he was traveling from San Francisco back to his hometown of Indianapolis. And he had been exhausted, really, by the time that he had spent on the streets in San Francisco. He was a young guy, 27 years old. He'd been outdoors for about 3 years at that point. And he just needed to go home and get himself together, recover, feel healthier. But once he got back to Indianapolis, where he was staying with a friend, that friend himself entered an addiction recovery program. And so about a month after I saw Quinn off at the bus station in San Francisco, he ended up back on the streets in San Francisco, more or less exactly in the same place as he had been when he arrived. So I think you're right to say that this might be a solution if a family or the receiver is really, really well set up to take care of that person. But if that's not the case, then as with Quinn, you may just end up in a similar situation to the one you were in before you were left.
If you do a lot of reporting around homeless people, it is a constant revelation how differently aged they are from their age cohort contemporaries, their peers. You'll meet a 40-year-old person who looks like they're 60. You'll meet a 60-year-old person who looks like they're 80. Scientists who study the effects of poverty call it weathering. Here is Quinn speaking to The Guardian from San Francisco.
The roughest part about being homeless is the wear and tear from the concrete and the constant walking. And it's hard to use the restroom because a lot of businesses don't want homeless people in their restrooms and messing them up. You know, it really breaks you down.
Breaks you down. I mean, Quinn is still, by many people's definitions, a young guy, but certainly didn't look like it anymore.
Well, as you mentioned, the life expectancy for people who are living on the streets is a lot younger. Homeless people, the life expectancy is, in fact, around 50 years old for chronically homeless people. So, yeah, they're dealing with a lot of really difficult weather, a lot of very harsh conditions. Quinn mentioned to me that he would sometimes walk miles and miles in a day, and this is in sort of chilly San Francisco fog. I mean, it's not a very, in the summer particularly, it's not a very pleasant place to be outdoors the whole time. So being homelessness is not something that's very easy to It's very difficult, let's put it that way.
One of the fascinating parts of the reporting was the maps, the graphics you put together, showing the movement of homeless people around the country. It almost was like there was a grass is always greener syndrome, because there were people moving to centers of American homelessness at the same time as there were large numbers of people moving away from those same places.
Right. Well, we actually looked at what the homeless population of San Francisco might have been if its own busing program had not existed. San Francisco, along with New York, has one of the largest programs in the nation. And we found out that over the last 10 years or so, that it had provided tickets to over 10,000 people who were traveling to other cities. And so we calculated that its current homeless population on any one night is around 7,000 to 8,000 people. And so if it had not had this bus program, we figured, and this is a very back of the envelope calculation, you know, there are lots of caveats, but we figured that roughly there might be as many as 18,000 people on the streets in San Francisco today had its program not existed, which is more than double the number that is presently in the city on any one night.
You're listening to On Point. Our listeners on Facebook are weighing in. Felix writes, rather than complaining that they get shipped away, how about we recognize many of them are homeless by choice? That choice should have consequences. Being bussed out and denied privileges seems like a reasonable approach, and we'll get to that later in the program. Jay writes, if sending them somewhere, they have resources to make their lives better. If that's the motivation, I'm for it. If they're just sending them to be a problem somewhere else, that's just wrong. Valera writes, what can be simpler than out of sight, out of mind? We're looking at the trends in U.S. cities offering their homeless one-way tickets out of town and what happens at the journey's end. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
I'm Cardiff Garcia.
And we are here with a new show,
The Indicator from Planet Money.
On every show, we take some number in the news and we dive into it to find the big idea behind it.
Get it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're looking this hour at homelessness in America and how each year U.S. cities give thousands of homeless people one-way bus tickets out of town. You can join the conversation. Does busing homeless people from one city to another sound like a solution or just passing the buck? Is it naive to think connecting a homeless person with a relative in a different city will get them off the streets? You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me from San Francisco is Alistair G., homelessness editor for The Guardian. He's now joined by his reporting partner, Julia Carey Wong, also from The Guardian. They worked on an 18-month-long investigation looking at how American cities relocate their homeless as part of their Outside in America series. You can link to it on our website, onpointradio.org. Julia Carey Wong, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having us.
Was there an aha moment in this reporting project, a moment where you thought you had a pretty good handle on what the story is, you had been covering it for a while, and then suddenly you see something, hear something, or meet somebody, and it kind of blows your mind?
I think that one of the kind of turning points for me as far as the reporting was when we started to interview some of the family members who actually received ticket recipients. We got our public records requests. In most cases, that we received the names of the individuals that actually took the bus tickets. But for one city, Sarasota, Florida, they actually provided us with the forms that people filled out when they said who it was that they were going to meet. And so this was an opportunity for us to really see the second half of the equation. As far as, you know, people say, well, I have a friend or I have family there, but who are those, you know, who are those people that are actually receiving the individual who's taking a bus ticket? And it was a small group. I think we probably had about 70 of these folks, but they were actually much easier to get in contact with because, of course, these were folks that have a permanent address, probably have a permanent, landline phone number. And the conversations, the interviews that we did with some of these folks were really interesting and really kind of put a new light on how much vetting goes into these programs. In one situation, I spoke to a man who was not a family member, but a former employer. And he said that he'd gotten a call from Sarasota about his former employee. He'd said, sure, he can come back here. I'll give him a job. And whether this was mentioned or not, but the man's intention was that he didn't have any place for the individual to stay. So this guy got on a bus from Florida, went to Michigan, and lived in a tent in, another homeless encampment in Michigan, but he did have a chance to have a job. In other situations, we spoke to family members who said, yes, this is my son. Yes, this is my nephew, but he burned this bridge years ago, which is something that I think is probably very common for folks who are experiencing homelessness, is that there are, complicated family relationships, and that might be part of the reason that somebody ended up homeless in the first place. And we also were able to find some family members who were still caring for and hosting the formerly homeless people, and kind of had very candid things to say about the challenges of of being that providing that level of support to somebody who had, been going through such a difficult time and had been living on the streets before they got a ticket back.
Julia Carey Wong and Alistair G. of The Guardian, stand by. I want to bring another voice into the conversation. Joining us from St. Petersburg, Florida, is Jane Walker. She's the executive director of Daystar Life Center, a nonprofit organization that works with the homeless. One of the services they provide is traveler's aid, a ticket that connects a person with a family or friend out of town. Jane, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Well, glad to be here.
You've heard from our reporters of some of the shortcomings of these programs. How does Daystar do it?
Well, I've been working with this population, the poor and the homeless, which there's many more of now than there was when I started 40 years ago, for a long time, and it really is traveler's aid. Our approach is if people can be stable, and we do make those calls for several reasons. One, to guarantee that they're not going to be homeless or going to another shelter, but also that there are no concerns with family members. Over my years of doing this, I've realized when somebody really wants somebody to come back, they say yes in 2 minutes. If they're going to say no, it'll take them half an hour to tell me why that's not a good idea. So we do keep in mind both ends of things. It is traveler's aid, not just Greyhound therapy, as it can be known. And our approach is we don't want people sending someone here without resources. We're not going to do that to other communities unless we can verify. Now, we do follow up with just to find out if they make it there. And one of the ones that stands out in my mind is a young woman who we got a Facebook back from 2 years later. We sent her to her brother in Oklahoma or the Midwest somewhere. She finished school. She's a social worker, and she just wanted to say thank you that it got her back on her feet. That's a good story. That doesn't always happen.
Yeah, that's a real success story. I mean,
right.
As you mentioned, and I'm glad you used that term, Greyhound therapy, because I guess we should keep in mind that a lot of these people are burdened by a tremendous range of problems that go far beyond just not having a place to live.
Correct. Yes. Yes, and we spend a lot of time trying to connect them to services here in the community. We get mail for about 1,800 people here at Daystar, and we're in a less than 4,000 square foot building. But often, because people use our mailing address, we'll get calls from relatives looking for somebody. and they're actually seeking out their loved one to reconnect. Sometimes that works. Sometimes it's the issues with the person on this end are they don't care about me, you know, there's some mental health issues, things like that. So, but we actually have family members seeking out, you know, I haven't seen my relative. Sometimes it's I want them to come home, but I'm in recovery. This is a recent one. I'm in recovery, so if they're actively using, that's not going to work for me. And he ended up not going back. So then a lot of times the relatives, once we make the phone call, they're willing to pay for it. We're just making the connection.
That, I guess, is a signal that there's a home that's ready to handle
right.
that person.
Correct.
Jane Walker, Executive Director of Daystar Life Center, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
A view from the trenches there from Jane Walker. Alistair G. and Julia Carey Wong are with us for the rest of the way. Callers, thank you for being so patient. We'll begin in Black River Falls, Wisconsin. Matt, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thank you. I was going to speak to as a family member that's brought in, both my brothers have been homeless and are recovering alcoholics. And my experience and has been that of a drug and alcohol counselor once told me that addicts break families apart. And I'm married with a two-year-old daughter, and we brought in my one brother, and he came out of the Marines and didn't really have anywhere to go, and so brought him in, got him a job. He has an alcohol problem, and obviously for us it was like, okay, no drinking, you know, and he just couldn't stop, and it's just you know, there was just a lot of drama, and it was just really hard for my wife and I to know exactly what to do. And I didn't want to kick him out on the streets. But after a suicide attempt and a gun was brought to our home, which was a rule that, you know, no guns in our house either, and we had to kick him out. And he stayed in my truck. I drive a semi-truck for a job. He stayed in my truck for a couple nights, and fortunately his job had a hotel job. But basically, it was one of the hardest decisions. And my other brother got out of treatment, and it was the same kind of deal where I need a place to live. I'm like, we can't bring you into our house. You know, like, families have to keep track of each other. And I helped him get a job. I helped him get an apartment with my other brother eventually. But basically, it's just a lot of stress, and it's something that a lot of people can't handle. And fortunately, we had the room for bringing somebody, and we had financial means to be able to do so, but in the end, it just was too dangerous for us. So,
well, yeah, sounds Matt, like you're a good brother, but you're not a substance abuse counselor, and you're not a therapist.
And the thing is, you can't save them. As much as you want to, and you want to do everything you can for them, you can't stop them from doing what they're going to do and the behavior, and you can't stop them from making terrible life choices as much as you'd like to. And that's the lesson I learned. And I hope family members out there with struggling family members, whether it's homeless or addictions, can also understand that. And so, but thank you, Ray.
Matt, thanks for your call. Alistair, Julia, you could hear in his voice, he wanted to help his brothers, but people bring a lot of problems with them when they come back home, and they're not necessarily, while they're loving and familiar, they're not necessarily equipped, are they?
Yes, you know, I mean, that's a very kind of heartbreaking situation, and it's one that we heard about from some of the other family members that we interviewed. I mean, one of the issues that I raised with some of the program managers that we interviewed about this was what, you know, having had the experience of speaking to family members who had wanted to help but had struggled to help, was asking them, you know, is there anything that you could do before somebody gets sent home to help prepare the family for how, you know, potentially difficult this might be? None of the programs that we interviewed had actually discussed that in any way, which was a little bit disheartening from our point of view. And I mean, I think that part of what you're seeing here is that when you have a homeless population as a large city, there's a sense of kind of public responsibility towards some of these, you know, social problems. And you hear, like, with a veteran returning home might have substance abuse, that's not an uncommon issue that, you know, veterans or folks experiencing PTSD might have. But the idea that a family can fix everything, you know, it's a very, you know, it's this idea that we can kind of privately solve problems that are actually kind of larger social problems that people might need more than just, you know, good intentions to be able to fix. And that's part of, I think, what sits behind kind of, you know, the good intentions, but the myth of these programs is that individual families aren't necessarily equipped to solve the level of problems that folks might be facing, and that these issues might need more systemic social public support than, you know, it's more than just a bed and a room.
Milwaukee, Wisconsin is next. Walter, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
Thanks for having me. I'm an Episcopal priest who, for 5 years, from 2011 to 2016, served a downtown Honolulu church. And my first evening there, a homeless gentleman came to the doors of the church and said he had just landed at the airport from Chicago, where Cook County Welfare had given him a one-way plane ticket to Honolulu. We tried to help him as best we could, and I eventually served on the board of the largest homeless services provider in the state of Hawaii. And this sort of, whether urban legend or rumor about cities on the mainland giving the homeless one-way plane tickets to Hawaii, paradise, where supposedly websites can tell you can live, you know, outdoors in a tent, be, quote, homeless off the grid, were commonplace, we were told. I was never personally able to verify these sorts of stories, the truth that governments would do this. We sometimes did learn that family members did, you know, give people one-way plane tickets to sort of, you know, dysfunctional families or families with issues. And obviously this type of population, it was maybe they gave up and would send people there. I can attest to what the folks from The Guardian are saying. These kinds of things almost never work, and particularly when you send someone that far away to an island far away from the U.S. North American continent. It's almost doomed to failure unless there are some kinds of support systems in place, and that means more than family. We did have one good story of a man who came to Hawaii, and we were able to set up a support system for him with a school in, of all places, Limerick, Ireland, where he was able to get a degree in music therapy. And after 2 years there, he was able to get a job, and he's now working as a music therapist at a nursing home in somewhere on the East Coast.
Well, that's quite a success story, that you were able to get him to a college and finish a credential and get a job. But Alistair, let's go back to Walter's first story about him just having someone at his door who arrived from Cook County, Illinois. Is that standard practice to give people? We've been talking about bus tickets through much of the program. Are there people getting plane tickets out there?
There are getting plane tickets out there. In fact, the largest program that we found in the nation, New York, also has this really unusual practice of giving out thousands and thousands of plane tickets. We found people traveling as far away as Wellington, New Zealand from New York. We also found around 2,500 people getting plane tickets from New York back to Puerto Rico. And so while most programs do have a domestic focus, New York is sending people across the world. We also got some data back from Hawaii, which shows that a nonprofit on Oahu is also subsidizing plane tickets back to the mainland for people who may have come from there in the first place.
Is it fair comment that it's tougher once you land someplace with no support system, no contacts, no network, that you become a public charge, as Walter suggests?
Undoubtedly, if you are going somewhere and there is no one there to help you, then it's going to be tricky for you.
We're talking about homelessness in America today. You can join the conversation. What do you see going on with the homeless population in your town? What's working, what isn't when it comes to helping? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
Make Up First a mainstay of your morning routine. 10 minutes and you get more than just the headlines. You get fresh perspectives and insight to start the day. It's the short, but not too short, morning news podcast from NPR. Listen to Up First on the NPR One app and wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're talking about homelessness in America today. For the first time since the Great Recession, the homeless population in our country is growing. With me from San Francisco, Alistair Gee, homelessness editor for The Guardian, and Julia Carey Wong, reporter for The Guardian. They worked on an 18-month-long investigation looking at how American cities relocate their homeless. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Lewis is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Lewis, welcome to the program.
Hello, Ray.
Hi.
Hi. Here in Charlotte, we see a lot of people off the highways begging for money in the rain. They're dirty. They don't have a change of clothes, obviously. To me, it's the saddest thing I deal with seeing in the course of my week. And to see these people breaks my heart. And I think of all the money this country spent on other things, and they can't take care of their own people that are in need. You know, DACA's big on the news. These aren't Americans. Americans are suffering and no one's doing anything. I have a problem with that. I'm sorry.
Is that kind of a false choice, Lewis? Can we walk and chew gum at the same time? Can we address the very real needs of DACA recipients and the very real needs of homeless people as well, rather than making it an either or?
I think we should have priorities. We should have priorities and we should take care of our own poor before we take care of someone else's.
Okay, fair enough. We'll go next to Madison, Wisconsin. Shay is on the line. Shay, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
Ray, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not a drug addict. I'm a very hardworking American citizen who invested decades of my money, time into a resort that was a family resort. My father died suddenly, and my family committed white-collar crimes against me, which put me directly in the street. I had no idea how the social system worked. I had no idea what was available. Being a small business owner, you put out fires all day with 68 employees in a growing business, as you may know. And what I found out was the support system. I had cancer, which I had 2 weeks to live, and 0% chance of survival. So I'm staying in my car and wanted to get into a homeless shelter. So I got into a homeless shelter. When they found out that I had cancer, they kicked me out immediately. You cannot be in a homeless shelter in the state of Wisconsin if you have cancer because it is an immune deficiency disease. So I'm assuming that they do the same thing to AIDS patients or anybody else. And there was no support network medically that would provide housing or any type of housing, and no landlord was going to give me anything.
Well, let's fast forward a little bit, Shay, because I guess we're talking about more than 2 weeks ago. So you lived, you're here, and I'm glad for that. How did you get out of the predicament that you were in? You were talking about how there were no services available. Are you still homeless? If not, how did you work your way out of your predicament?
It was an interesting journey. I networked the help of an oncologist at Columbia St. Mary's Hospital because Frederick Hospital gave me a ton of drugs and told me to go home and die. I didn't do that. I'm a fighter and I'm innovative. So I got a hotel room with the help of a business associate that I had at the time. He spent hundreds of dollars for me to be in the hotel while I was going through chemotherapy. He was the most generous man I could ever even know. But I did real estate development with him, and he knew I was a straight shooter and a hard worker. 2 weeks to live, no chance of survival. Yes, Medicaid had to give me coverage of my medical services. However, being a hardworking person in America, I felt that I should be able to recover my resort, recover my investments, all of the money that I invested into the resort, and not be on Medicaid, not be a part of the state aid. But my family, who committed the crimes against me, the white-collar crimes, are multimillionaires living on lakes with big boats and lots of fun travel. While they kicked the person with the need to the curb, which I found out afterwards, Medicaid was invented and Medicare services for families that cannot deal with people that are elderly or have disease or anything else. It's the only safety net. And I don't like going to the Medicaid office. I don't like the way they treat me. I'm not used to it.
Well, Shay, I'm going to turn your story to Alistair and Julia because I think you bring up a very important point that people have services, programs designed to meet their need, but getting them hooked up, if you're a person, let's say, as Shay was, with a chronic illness, with a life-threatening illness, it's not a straight line between you, your need, and the provision of services that you actually should have been able to rely on. Aren't there a lot of homeless people who need medical treatment who aren't getting it? Julia?
I think Alistair might take this one.
Yeah, I'll jump in there, right? Yeah, I think it is true to say that you do see, especially people who've been on the streets for a long time, chronically homeless people, you see people going in and out of hospital the whole time. It's a really unfortunate situation where obviously a hospital can't hold someone beyond a few nights, and you have someone with a chronic need. And so the result is that that person, rather than getting what they really need, which is housing, they just end up going in and out of the hospital the whole time for treatment. That there's now a trend or an idea that's coming out of Hawaii and other places of an idea that housing, in fact, is healthcare, and that one of the best ways to treat or to help people who are really chronically homeless is instead of offering them medical treatment or insisting they go through sobriety treatment before they get housing, is just to give that person housing right away. And that in and of itself is a really important way to deal with homelessness, as opposed to, as you said, just having to try and help them perhaps ineffectively just get hooked up with services that they may find hard to access while they're living in such an unstable situation.
Augusta, Georgia is next. Ryan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. I have a question. First, let me tell a short story. I was driving the other morning, my partner, to the ER at about 3:00 in the morning. And there is a homeless issue in the Augusta area. I don't know the numbers by any means. And underneath an overpass, you could see a man bundled up. It's about 20 degrees outside or so. And I drive by and think to myself, I wish there was something I could do. And then it hit me that I had a Christmas present back there that I had been given, actually. It was a blanket. And I turned around and, and rolled my window down and said to the guy, hey, you can come get it if you want to. And he told me, he said, bring it to me. I can't walk. So I got up and I got out of the car and noticed the man was in a wheelchair. And I spent the next 20 minutes with him talking about how he had came recently to Augusta from Kentucky. He was looking for his sister, had found she was disabled in a home herself, and he couldn't get to her. And he had been in a shelter, in the hospital. This kind of hits off of your last call, I believe it was, actually. And he had nowhere to go because he was around-the-clock care. And his last thing he said to me was, after we talked for a while, remember me and come visit me when you can find me again. What is your average person, can they do to help out somebody like this? I mean, beyond just giving them a blanket or giving them a meal, is there something that a citizen of the city can do to help out more? And that's really what my question is.
Ryan, thank you for that question, because in 30 years of covering homelessness as a reporter, that's one of the most frequent things I'm asked by members of the public. When I see this, what can I do? So, Julia, what would we tell Ryan?
Well, this, I'm going to give a slightly odd answer because I don't actually know, you know, what an advocate might say is a best practice. But I do think, honestly, that what the caller said about actually stopping and having a conversation and speaking with this gentleman who was experiencing homelessness is actually a really important thing to do. People who experience street homelessness are there's a mental cost, I think, to being treated the way that folks who are living on the streets are treated, to not having folks make eye contact, to not having folks speak with them and treat them like human beings, which they are, and which it can be, you know, folks are, you know, walking to work, driving to work, you see somebody, it's not necessarily pleasant to have to consider poverty like that. And yet, actually taking the time to make eye contact, speak with somebody, you know, if it's somebody that you see every day, build up a relationship, talk with folks. I mean, I think that there's a lot of trauma that folks experience on the street that's linked to the kind of dehumanization of being forced to live in those circumstances. And so treating people with kindness and respect and as individuals, I think, is a good step. You know, and then I also think that, you know, the housed have a responsibility to, you know, speak to public officials about actually making a change to, you know, our housing policies, to the amount of funding that goes to affordable housing, to supportive housing units, because this is a systemic issue. It's not something that any one individual is going to be able to fix by buying somebody a hot meal, even if that something might help an individual, you know, in the moment, but actually, you know, pushing for our entire society to start spending more money on housing.
Well, you're reminding us that there's a political dimension to this, not just a humane one. Annapolis, Maryland is next. Sarah, welcome to the program. Hiya, Sarah.
Great. We need a concentrated base for the homeless with programs that can support them. We could simplify it because the communities who are not minding homeless bases, where I live near Baltimore, and we have what's called tent cities. There is very good reason why communities do not like these types of homeless communities near their homes. They are well known to have high incidences of extreme mental problems. They have extreme drug abuse problems. And there's a lot of crime that surrounds those communities. If we could simplify it by having a vote within the communities that do not mind having these communities there, we could then put in resources near those communities for them, such as researchers to live right nearby where this the problem can be researched for future problem solving, where we could have job programs right there for them. And then the surrounding community that wants them there and isn't opposed to them being near their homes, they could help out and do the hot meal, do the blanket giving, and the additional things on top of the services and resources. Now, I know it sounds like we're going to have, like, you know, basically like an Indian reservation, but we have it anyway. Baltimore, all the way down to its suburbs, every median strip, you can see tents back in the woods. There's a place down here in the Baltimore suburb where they had tons and tons what they called tent city. And the police keep moving the whole thing, and then they just all recongregate. We need to take a vote and find out where we can say, okay, this is land, or maybe even have land set aside where they can go, and then the people who want to support those and the resources that can support them can be right nearby.
Let's go to Alistair G. You can hear the frustration in Sarah's voice. What do you have to say to her?
Well, I think, as Julia just mentioned, and as you mentioned, Ray, there really is a political dimension to this, and it is about, at the end of the day, government priorities. We recently did a story that showed that the government spends around $30 billion on rental assistance for the poorest Americans. That's Section 8 housing. Essentially, you get a rental voucher if you don't have anywhere to stay. But the government spends twice that amount on the mortgage interest deduction for the richest Americans. That's essentially a deduction you can take, and it tends to go to only the wealthiest families. So that's really a reflection of where our government's spending priorities are now, that there are far fewer resources available for people who are on the edge of homelessness than there are for people who are building simply larger or more luxurious houses. And so I'm very sympathetic to some of the caller's concerns. It obviously that there is this is an issue that is not easy to solve. But I do think that the political dimension is a really important place to start. And just thinking about the kind of resources that we allocate to the problem, it is a really important thing to do.
Roger writes on Twitter, increases in poverty and homelessness are the direct result of concentration of wealth in the capitalist class. A comment from our website from Dave, I don't know what to do to solve the problem, but I know we can give to shelters, food, clothing, blankets, money, time, whatever. And Carozza writes, my experiences with homeless people in New York City and Boston are that homelessness is the result of mental illness, neurological disorders like autism spectrum, and other disabilities which often lead to self-medication and addiction. Ray in Vermont writes, with the recent cold weather, VPR, Vermont Public Radio, did some reporting on homelessness locally, and even though there were attempts to open enough shelters and other locations to accommodate everyone, there were some who were deciding to still sleep outside in their vehicles. I want to say thanks for joining us to our guests this hour. Julia Carey Wong, reporter for The Guardian, great to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Alistair G., the same to you as well.
Thank you very much, Ray.
Alistair is the homelessness editor for The Guardian. You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, the ethics of creating artificial intelligence. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.